This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on June 18th, 2015. We are at the Norwegian Developers Conference in Oslo, Norway, and we're talking with Udi Dahan for the first time in about 5 years. You were a very early guest, and since that time, you have started a company.
That's right.
And it all centers around...
Well, it started with InService Bus. It's the open source project that I started several years earlier, which is what we did our original podcast on.
Yes.
That was on InService Bus. And so I started that project back in 2007. And then at the end of 2010, I opened a company around it.
And the idea was to put something behind InService Bus where you could make it commercial or sell it, or?
Well, so my motivation for doing that was, you know, I was kind of like the victim of my own success. It was great. I was doing training and I was doing consulting and I was flying around the world. I'm like, oh yeah, this is great. And then after about a year where the number of code contributions had kind of dwindled to like a line of code per month, I was like, oh crap. Wait, no, it's not supposed to work this way. You know, I as a consultant, I couldn't stand in front of my clients with integrity and say, hey, you should use this, if there was no actual development being done on it. And people can talk about all of the open sourcey contributors. You know, there are lots of people that use it, but you get a really small fraction of contributions. So I kind of felt that model would not hold up, that... You know, if there wouldn't be more code coming into it, people would eventually have to rip it out and replace it with something else. So I was actually doing my users a disservice by continuing under the free open source model. And I wasn't at all sure that commercializing it would work. I mean, there weren't really any precedents in the .NET world of taking an open source project commercial. It's like, you know, I don't know, but what I'm doing is not going to live long, so I'm going to try this other thing. Community, please forgive me. I'm doing this for the best. I'm not doing this for the money. I was making very good money as a consultant. I said, look, you know, but we're going to give this a try. And I mean, it worked out for the best, but the whole commercializing it was not for the money. My belief was, well, as long as there's actual revenue tied to the product itself, then even if I decide 2 years down the road that I want to go do something else, it would be, I don't want to say easy, it would be much more possible to find somebody else, another company who'd be willing to stand behind it because there would be a business model for them to work into, and then my clients would have guaranteed longevity.
And this was 2010, you said?
That was at the end of 2010, yeah.
2010. So obviously things have worked out because the company is still around and has grown.
Yes, yeah.
And you are based in...
What's in Israel.
In Israel.
Right.
But you have team members that are...
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
No, not everywhere. Everywhere is a little bit overblown, but we've got Sweden and Norway and Italy and Ireland and Australia and the U.S. and Canada. And there's probably some more that I'm forgetting, but...
Yeah. And these are both technical people and also things like sales and marketing and evangelism, right?
So, I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's... So when we started out, it was kind of just me. Then the first thing that I realized... So for all of you listening, they're like, hey, I've got an open source project. I'm going to commercialize it. It's going to be awesome. Udi said it was great. I got to tell you, the first couple of months, I was like, oh my God, this is awful. And you might be wondering, what could be awful about commercializing something? The thing is, once you want to go to sell something to a company, they're like, oh, that's great. We just have this 50-page contract that you need to sign.
Right, right.
And I'm like, what? No, can't you just swipe your credit card and give me money and that'll be done? And they're like, oh, no, we've got all of these termination clauses and indemnification. I'm like, I'm not a lawyer. So I asked around and got referred to a good lawyer, and he's like, okay, so this is what all of this stuff means. Like, right, so what do I do? It's like, well, that's not my job. I just tell you what it means. You've got to decide whether it's worth the risk to actually accept these terms or to try to negotiate and lose the deal. I was like, crap, that's not how it's supposed to work.
Can I just write code?
Yeah. I did this so that I could write code and get paid for writing code and not have to worry about any of that crap. So it was a very steep learning curve of getting through all, I mean, the company and incorporation, that's easy. But actually selling software and finding out what those terms mean and pricing, oh my God. It's like, I thought pricing was easy. You just put a price on a thing and people buy it. But then people are like, well, you know, my company works a little bit differently. You know, we're targeting the cloud, so we could have as few as 2 servers and as many as 200 at a time. So your per core pricing, that doesn't work for us. Like, right, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's do per developer pricing. And you got some other company that says, yeah, we want to do per developer pricing too. We've got 5,000 servers in our big, gigantic Fortune 5 bank. And we have 2 developers working on this thing. We're a hedge fund or something, and we make billions of dollars. So here's, you know,
$20.
Yeah,
whatever.
Like that. And I'm like, no, that's not fair. Like, well, that's your pricing model. So, all of those things, you don't actually realize what a crazy world it is and how difficult it is to actually get this stuff to work.
You have a lot of big customers, so do you find yourself, is each one of those sort of a custom license that you put together?
There's usually a negotiation that happens around the contract. It's gotten better over time because I can kind of know, after having done this enough times before, yeah, that's okay. These are the 2 sticking points, and then we just kind of work through those.
Right. So you mentioned that going through and settling on a commercial model. Mm-hmm. What is that? And especially going from an open source
where product, it's free, you know, for everybody.
Exactly.
Right?
So what model did you kind of settle on?
What model did we settle on? We have a couple of standard models that we use, but one of the things that I didn't like when I looked at other service bus technologies, they had one very simple model. Call for a quote.
Yeah. Everyone loves that.
I'm coming from an open source background. I want to be transparent and I want to be able to show the value of this. But in dealing with large customers, that's really the only model that works is this, well, we need to actually sit down and put together a quote for you. But for kind of the normal development world, let's call it that, the pricing is as simple as $25 per month for like a developer machine. So less what most people would pay for coffee.
Yeah. So how did that work for you? Had an open source product. Right. Did that continue on? Is there a community edition or what sort of license is code available still or is it kind of?
Right. So we left all the code on GitHub. We just changed the type of open source license that we use from the, I think we had an Apache license in the early days, and we switched it to the more restrictive RPL.
Okay.
So it's still open. We accept pull requests, and we get a bunch of pull requests, and it's fantastic. And we manage our issues out on GitHub, and people open up issues, and we have discussions with the community. So in that sense, it's still very open source in nature. Really, the only difference is that element of, well, if you want to use it in a commercial setting where you don't want to release your code under the same license, then we have a separate license.
And what is RPL? What does that stand for?
It's the reciprocal public license.
Okay. I've heard also another common one, like ServiceStack went with, I think, AGPL.
Right.
AGPL is another
commercial
but open source license.
Right. Luckily, our lawyers are
smart.
Are smart guys.
That's their job, huh?
And there's actually one of the partners there that specializes in open source. So he said, you know, AGPL is good. However, the problem is that, say, you know, big bank, big insurance company doing a project for thousands of their employees, AGPL just stipulates that they have to release their code to their users.
Oh.
So as long as they do that, they get to use it for free. Now you're looking at that saying, wait a minute, that's not what I thought would happen by using this AGPL license. So it's a loophole that actually allows large companies to develop big, expensive projects for their internal employees and not have to pay for the software. RPL means, no, you need to release it out to the rest of the world under this same license, not only to your users.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, open source licenses are so important, and they're hard to understand. This is working at Microsoft. This is a big deal. They want open source stuff, but licenses are important, you know, commercial. It's cool to see open source being a viable, thriving business model, though, you know. I mean, to be able to...
Well,
okay.
I've had some conversations. I mean, there are two common open source business models. The most prevalent one is that it is still left as free open source, whether that's Apache, BSD, MIT, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, okay, so where's the business model, right? If it's free for everybody, where's the business model?
Service, right?
Right. So ultimately, it's being built around services. Now the problem with the service-based business is that it's really skewed to large customers. Mm-hmm. In other words, the vast majority of the market is not going to pay for any services at all. And then you'll have a small number of big, gigantic customers that end up paying for all of your services. Now, the reason we didn't go down that path was that I looked at that and said, well, okay, first of all, you become wholly dependent on a handful of customers.
Right.
One of them leaves you, and then your business is in trouble. So it's kind of a risky business. The second part is because your entire revenue is based on the big, large customers, you're competing with big incumbent vendors, IBM, TIBCO, Oracle, etc., and they have much deeper pockets than you to actually work through any sale. So it's in their tactics are ultimately long, drawn-out RFP processes. They come to the CIO and they say, you know what? Let's have a bake-off and let the best vendor win. Because we believe in our platform, we're not going to charge you anything at all for this proof of concept phase. We'll have our people come in and we'll set up the servers and we'll configure things. We'll do this at cost. And if in the end you realize that our technology is superior, then you pay us. If not, then you don't. Sounds perfectly fair and reasonable. However, when you consider the fact that IBM has extremely deep pockets, and you're coming in and you'd like to win a deal like that, mm-hmm. where are you going to get the money from to pay your people to rack the servers, to do all this stuff for 6 months, 12 months? IBM's sitting there saying, I don't understand what you're talking about. Yeah. This is perfectly fair play.
Yeah.
And the only way you can have a chance of living through a sales process is actually to go to try and raise venture capital to have somebody give you the float so that maybe you can actually survive and win some deals.
Yeah.
That's the common open source business model. Now you can understand, based on how I described it, why I wasn't so thrilled with it.
Yeah.
Not to mention lots of wining and dining and golf matches, I would suppose, with the IBM sales business.
Yeah. Like I said, I didn't go down that path, and I don't think I could have afforded it, even if I wanted to.
But you've been successful. I mean, now you have employees in, 12 or 15 different time zones. What tips do you have to pull that off, to manage that?
So first of all, you never go from zero to a large number right away. I mean, so it started out with just having one person to kind of help me out with administrative work. Then one of the contributors to the open source project from Sweden, his name's Andreas Ullin, he's working at a consulting company at the time and using the technology at projects for his client. I said, hey, you know, how about coming working part-time on an hourly basis? And that's how kind of there was the next employee. So it really started out kind of tapping the community of contributors and users and say, you know, can I get some hours from you and some hours from you, and kind of really bootstrapping the thing, a couple of hours here, a couple of hours there. And so it's that kind of long, drawn-out process in the beginning of finding somebody and having them kind of moonlighting from their day job off to the side until you kind of build up enough momentum. You're like, okay, I think I can hire you full time. That I think that was the tipping point, the first tipping point where I kind of felt confident enough that I could say, okay, leave your job and come work for me full time.
Right, right.
And of course, they're like, yeah, this is awesome. And their spouse is like, I'm sorry, what?
Right.
These guys don't have an office. They're like...
How do you handle communications? How do you keep everyone in sync?
It's an ongoing effort. I mean, when having people in multiple time zones, I think there are two forces at play. The first one is write everything down. So all of the things that are obvious and everybody knows about, write them down somewhere. So we make use of extensive GitHub repositories for documenting things as issues or in readmes and creating all sorts of links between things so that what's in our heads becomes a collective searchable body of knowledge that anybody coming to the company can read through and kind of catch up to speed on. So that's number one. Number two, lots and lots of web conferencing. You know, it's usually we'll have several of these calls in a day with various numbers of people in different time zones that, you know, what's been going on over there, what's been going on over here, what issues do we have to deal with, and then kind of splinter off into a smaller group that is focused on that one issue, and then documenting things after the fact. So it's really trying to move towards asynchronous communication by writing things down so that we leave a trail of breadcrumbs so that people in other time zones can catch up afterwards. We record all of the web conference meetings that we have so people can download them and watch them at 1.5-2 speed and kind of catch up. But it's a challenge with more people coming on and more activities to keep people in sync. But it's been working.
Cool. Yeah, that writing down and asynchronous is so important because I've seen, you know, I work remotely for Microsoft. It's always a challenge. Nobody can ever seem to set up a video conference, right, and stuff. And, but a lot of the time it's either in-person communication or it's like chat. Hey, are you there? Nope. Okay, then I'm moving on to talk to somebody else. Mm. Where it's really important to keep, like you're saying, those written communications, the breadcrumbs and stuff. And it's not, like sometimes people will see that kind of stuff as a burden. But really it's like it makes it so much easier over time. If you do have that kind of documentation.
Right. I'm not sure that I'd say it makes it easier. It's a maturity forcing function. In other words, if you're able to get through it, then you're able to do more with people all over the world. So you kind of have this ability. I mean, for us growing, having a workforce that is in multiple time zones for support is amazing because then, you know, if the customer has a 2 a.m. issue, for somebody else, it's 3 p.m. and that's just fine.
Right, right.
So it's great having that, but it requires, you know, much, it's not just, okay, let's have 10 people in the room and they'll sort things out between each other. It forces the group to formalize processes, to write things down. It feels like a burden when you're going through it, but then when you add the 11th person to the group and they get up to speed and they're productive in just a couple of weeks, like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow. And it just kind of continues, that sort of virtuous cycle from there.
So, change of direction. I've always appreciated your deep thinking and insight into the various crazy things that happen in this industry. So, let me just throw a few terms out there and just say whatever comes to mind.
Okay.
Microservices.
Microservices, what comes to mind? Oh, well, that's a loaded question. What I don't like about microservices first. I don't like the fact that it is so deeply tied to the deployment model. It reminds me of back in the day, there was this guy, maybe you know him, that said, everything should be a WCF service.
I've heard of this guy, yeah.
Yes. And luckily, we as an industry at the time said, no, that's a horrible idea. Let's not do that. But like many horrible ideas, you give them 5 or 10 years, and then people say, you know, maybe we should do that after all. So it feels like that type of everything is a little microservice, when it never was architecturally sound to begin with. That's what I don't like about it.
Sure.
What I do like about it is that it's kind of been part and parcel with the DevOps movement of building better tooling, more lightweight tooling, be able to manage larger distributed systems, and that's done great things for us. So the tooling part has been great. I think the architectural side of things is still lacking quite a lot in the conversation in the microservices space.
Okay. You gave a talk this week about CQRS. What jumps to mind with CQRS these days?
One could say that CQRS was kind of like the previous hype, which I was a part of fanning the flames of. In many ways, I could say that CQRS was a kind of reaction to the ORM-heavy, big, gigantic domain model with all of the relationships in it and the kind of complexity that brought about in our systems. So CQRS was kind of like, let's swing the pendulum back the other way. Instead of having big, gigantic domain models, let's start talking about how we can splice our system top to bottom and have different, more specific logic that is focused on different parts of things. That was a good first step. The CQRS community has now, as a whole, come to the agreement that CQRS is not meant to be the top-level architecture. That would be the domain-driven design type of bounded context subdomain thing, which is, so there's a bigger division of your architecture on top of CQRS. If you decide to use CQRS in a bounded context or not, that, you know, you can or you can decide not to, depending on its needs. So I think that bit has kind of solidified pretty well, though there are still companies that say, we're going to do a CQRS project. That's kind of like saying, we're going to do an Inhibernate project.
Right.
It's like, that's not really what's important here.
Right. What about event sourcing these days?
Event sourcing. I think that the important thing about event sourcing is that it guides developers to write lock-free domain models. Now, lock-free domain models are really important when you're in a high-contention domain. Now, the thing is, nobody realizes they're in a high-contention domain until their system kind of gets an Oprah Winfrey moment, where all of a sudden you get tons of users that are hitting your site, but it's not just that they're hitting your site. They're interested in a very specific thing. So it's like, I don't know, that if we're talking about like a Ticketmaster, it would be I'm trying to think who is the latest teen heartthrob. Not Justin Bieber.
Right. No?
He's over. Okay. Yeah. I've got teenage daughters. They're we don't like Justin Bieber.
Let's just say Ozzy Osbourne.
Right.
Okay, whatever. So
big with the young children these days.
Right. So there's some concert, and then you get a spike in traffic, but it's all localized on that one thing. You have a massive amount of contention, all dealing with, say, inventory of seats for that specific thing.
Yeah.
So when you get localized spike in traffic, and the thing is, it's kind of unpredictable, that's when you get high contention and the system can just come to its knees. So event sourcing, by promoting this type of lock-free data modeling business logic programming, allows you to build a system that is able to handle those types of spikes very well. Now, there's, let's call it, an event sourcing as a style of thinking versus event sourcing as the tactical, here is one way of doing it.
Right.
And Greg Young, the father of event sourcing, has kind of tried to go on the record and say, look, you don't need the event sourcing framework or this, just, keep these principles in mind. And in my talk the other day, I showed how you do event sourcing with TSQL on top of a relational database. It's more in the data modeling that instead of updating a record, you just append a new record with the same identifier, and then your query performs some kind of aggregate on it. So it's not rocket science to do this stuff, but it's those specific problem domains where it's really important to use it.
So if I'm Ticketmaster and I'm selling tickets to Ozzy Osbourne or whatever, Taylor Swift, whatever it is. Okay, so tons of, see, I have kids.
Yeah.
Okay, so orders are coming in, and I originally had, like, say, one table that had seats available or whatever, right?
Right.
So what, and now I move that to appending records for, like, how would I concretely hit right. that Ticketmaster scenario?
So.
Rats, recording cut out just for a second here. So Udi was describing how moving to an event sourcing model might mean that instead of, you know, pulling and waiting for an exact order for an exact seat, instead I'm giving the system my requirements. I would like a group of tickets in a block, and then it's able to tell me within a period, you know, short period of time, whether that order's been filled and what my exact seats were assigned, and how that could fit a very high percentage of user requirements.
Okay, so you're saying about the percent of, like, if you're okay with that, you know.
Right. So, you know, this type of Upstart comes along and is being able to do things much more efficiently because they were operating on a lock-free business model, then, you know, maybe the bottom 80% of the market says, you know what? I'm willing to wait 5 minutes. And the funny thing is, if you've ever used the Ticketmaster website, you end up waiting 5 minutes for the damn screen to refresh anyway.
Fair enough.
It's not like you have an amazing user experience.
No.
It's totally blocking. So saying, you know, instead of sitting on the website and finding out that I didn't get what I wanted in quote-unquote real time, I could go and do other things and get an email that actually tells me the majority of the time that I got a seat. Do I care that it's in row 17 rather than row 15? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's good insight. So here's one more question. Mm-hmm. When you're not running your company or tinkering with N-Service Bus or coming to NDC, what do you do to relax or have fun?
So I've got 4 kids. I don't know if that falls under the category of relax.
Well, yeah, that would certainly be some
but,
work.
Yes, but it definitely does take up my time, and it's you know, for anybody who's a parent, you know, that is a big
How
source of fulfillment.
How old's the oldest and youngest?
My eldest is 13 and a half, and my youngest is 4.
Okay, so yeah, that's a lot of interaction.
Yes, indeed.
Well, thanks for being on the show, Udi.
Thank you so much for having me. Great catching up.
We'll have to do this again before another 5 years goes by. So
indeed.
We wish you continued success with your company and N-Service Bus, and thanks everyone for listening.
Yep.
Thanks a lot, guys.